Sunday Papers on Off The Ball.
Good morning, very welcome to this Sunday's paper review. The day Ireland are playing France in the Six Nations. Big afternoon for Joe Schmidt's side. We are streaming at the moment on Off The Ball across all our Off The Ball social channels. You can catch us on Periscope, on Twitter. You can catch us on Facebook Live at the moment at Off The Ball on YouTube as well. I'm joined this afternoon on the pay-per-view by Hugh Farrelly of the Irish Mail on Sunday. How are you, Hugh?
Grand, thank you.
And Mick O'Keefe, CEO of Teneo Ireland.
That's right.
Thanks
thank
for
you.
Joining us this afternoon. Hugh, when you came in this morning, I was talking to you actually. It's been, I'm sure a lot of people would have read, a very difficult week for people in your stable and the Irish Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday.
Yeah, it's a strange week. People might have read about the redundancies that have been, they're looking for in the Mail. 35, they said, job-wise and stuff. But it's not just the Mail, so everyone's trying to adjust to that. Do they take packages and all this kind of stuff? But it's across the board, Neil. You know, I mean, I was talking to guys in the India, the same thing's going on there. The Examiner's been taken over by the Irish Times. They're scaling back. So, you know, it's not like, I mean, there's no point, I sent you outside, you know, journals coming on and bemoaning the growth of the internet. You know, people don't want to listen to that. We've known this is going to happen for years. It's just what concerns me. And even looking at the papers today now, you know, they're so strong, so much time, effort, quality gone into it. What comes after? You know, because you're going to lose good journalists for whom it's a trade. You know, like you learn it from the ground up. You start out, you're sent to, you know, I remember doing like schools, games, you work your way up gradually and you grow as you go and there's codes of practice and stuff. And if these guys go, what comes after? I've already noticed now that you see journalists using Twitter as a source. Mm-hmm. Like, that makes no sense to me. No, I'm at this 20 odd years, like, but I don't get how you can trust Twitter as a source rather than ringing up somebody on the phone or meeting them face to face. I mean, I don't do Twitter, but I imagine if you left your laptop open and your Twitter account, I could go in and type something in. I mean,
you could,
but people
I'd be fairly unhappy with you.
But you know, so the whole industry is in a state of flux, and there's no point saying, like, I'm not going to blow sunshine up News Talk's AMP, but like these kind of shows are important because they emphasize the quality that's there, and we've seen it in other areas like the Civita case or McCabe and stuff, that's coming from trained journalists.
Yeah, and
what comes after if it's just all online? Because I'll get off the soapbox now, but like we're in this kind of, I was up in Belfast there a few weeks ago and we went for a pizza, whatever, and there was a family next to us with three kids from 16 to 9 and all five of them were on tablets or phones, headphones, eating pizza, like, and everyone just swiping. Like we're in a swipe culture where there's a lack of concentration, and you pick up these papers today, you have to commit to it. Maybe that's the problem, you know, maybe people don't have the time or attention, but I just worry for the quality of what comes after if newspapers go under.
Yeah, and particularly in your case as well, I would have known from working on this show now for the last 6 months or so that just how often we find ourselves dipping back into the Mail on Sunday. Just there's a lot of great kind of off the beaten track interviews each week and things like that.
Yeah, and I mean, all the papers are trying that, and you know, papers themselves have a case to answer. There's been a bit of complacency there. We still go along. You know, there's too much time given to the sponsors' gigs and stuff. I mean, the market has changed. I think, you know, it's not newspapers anymore. You can't keep up to speed. I mean, it just changes. Like, so more opinion, more analysis, more color, more exclusive interviews, and the days of scoops are gone now because you could break a story. I don't know, Conor Murray going to Saracens. And it's on the back page and the website.
You're not breaking that now, are you?
No.
just clear that illustration.
I just took that as a random example.
So
that type of story would be a big scoop back in the day. Nowadays, the websites swoop in and it's everywhere. So there's no need to buy the paper to read about it, you know.
I think I think there's a whole kind of myriad of factors that have led us to this situation. One is you had a double whammy of an economic recession with a whole change in how media is consumed in this country 10, 12 years ago.
And right at the same time.
Exactly the same time. And I think, you know, what we're looking specifically at is people are getting information from so many different sources. And I think print has been the one that has been squeezed. And it's a shame because there hasn't been huge innovation in print in about 10 years. The papers look ish the same as what they did 10 years ago. And I think resources have been pulled out, and there's been media owners in this country who haven't put an emphasis on talent and journalism. And what's happened is the quality of the product has then suffered at times too. So, you know, what we found in our industry, which is communications and media, which is a kind of a first cousin, is that we're getting a huge quality of entry-level graduates because, and I know this from talking to editors and newspapers, there's a generation that's been lost in print journalism. There's very few really talented 25, 26, 27-year-old print journalists, because why would you go into print journalism at the moment where it's at this particular juncture? And you look and see, well, where are the opportunities going to go? And I suppose in a time like this where there's so much change, there's things like podcasting and long-form content. There's the obviously digital media consumption, but myself and you were talking about it earlier around big organisations, big banks, sports organisations are actually becoming publishers themselves, and they're skipping the middleman, which was always the media, to get to their end source. Now, that provides opportunities for quality content, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't provide a filter for PR, and I'm coming from that stable. So, you know, having really forensic, talented, opinion-forming print journalists is something that we've benefited from in this country for three, four decades and more. And how is that gap going to be filled in a world of media consumption via Facebook, Twitter? I don't know. I think things like this are important because you can have a conversation.
Well, excellent point, because I know the RFU are unashamedly saying they want to promote their channels. Mm-hmm. You know, so they won't come out and say publicly that they, you know, that traditional media is down the pecking order, but that's what they want to push everything on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, all this kind of stuff, and speak directly to the fans. And, you know, that's grand. You know, you get your clips of players at training and all that kind of stuff. But as Mick says, there's no, you know, it's okay, it's very hard to criticise the likes of Joe Schmidt now, he's been so successful, but you need to have the capacity to read criticism as well, you know, and that could vanish too. But the other thing about the whole decline, and as I say, I don't want to dwell on that, on the obvious, but there's a financial aspect to it. You know, we're asking people to pay, what is it, 360 for, you know, when, and they're kind of go, well, I can get stuff, I'll just read what's free.
Yeah.
And, you know, papers, I think, naively thought they could transfer it online and do paywalls. And we all know, you hit a paywall, you go elsewhere, you know. People only like putting their credit card into the internet if they're booking a flight or, you know. So that adjustment has been tough. And the only way to do it is, unfortunately, as the papers decline and they move online, the advertisers follow online, but it won't be the same.
So newspapers have been very slow to evolve, and you know, and then it went from the model of pushing the newspaper content online, giving away for free, which is absolutely crazy when you think about it. And you think of the business model of the newspapers, and you know, it's on print. You've got to cut down trees to make, you got to put these things into a print machine. You put them in a car and you put them out to shops all over the country. As a business model, it's a very difficult business model. I still firmly believe, and I'm not saying this as a dinosaur of media, like, I think there is a future for print the same way there's a future for long form radio content. And it just needs to bottom out, I think, in terms of where, I think people will struggle to pay for news in a newspaper. But it doesn't mean they won't pay for other things.
Almost like a magazine.
Yeah, they'll pay for features, opinion, and some of the stuff we're reading today. It's not the best day ever for sports journalism, but there's some brilliant stuff in here.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you get time to get into it, that you won't get elsewhere. And it is a different product. And, you know, you go back to, you know, we used to lobby for the publicans, very bad example now, but like people say, oh, you can buy a can of beer for 99 cents and you've got to pay $4.50 in a pub. And you go, well, that's fine. If you want to drink a can of beer in the field, that's fine, but a pint is a different experience.
Yeah.
And a newspaper, a newspaper, a news, how do we get here?
You're out in the field drinking Dutch gold.
I just, my point is that it's a different experience, a newspaper, than flicking on the bus on your phone. And it needs to be sold as such. But I think the papers need to evolve as well. And they haven't done because they haven't had investment to do so.
Everyone's, you know, it's nervy. It's interesting you say about radio, actually, because radio hasn't changed essentially since the days of, you know, John McCormack on the wireless. Like, people can still do stuff and switch on the radio. So radio's kind of survived. Do you find that?
In bits and pieces. Like, they're, you know, like, we look at what we're doing at Off the Ball, and we've put so much emphasis in the last year about, you know, we've put this studio together so that we're not just going out on a Sunday afternoon on a radio station. We're going out across YouTube. We're going out across Facebook. People on Twitter can see us through the Periscope link. We'll be cutting clips up of this to use throughout the week. On, you know, you've Off the Ball AM tomorrow morning. which will
and
be.
And do people watch it, Neil? Or like, because I'd always listen to news.
Think
stuff.
So, Anya?
No, I don't. I don't mean like has it appeal. I mean,
we hope so.
I would still be of the throw on news talk while I'm, you know, tidying up or whatever. Yeah. Like I'd have it in the background. But are people actually tuning into the video side of things?
Yeah, like, and I mean, I think the lads would have kind of strategically planned to have it that kind of 7:45 on weekday mornings, so someone getting the bus to work can flick it on, even if you don't want to watch it on. Watch the video itself, you can just listen to the audio feed on offtheball.com, you know. Yeah. So there's like, even from a radio point of view, when I would have started in radio about 4 years ago, things have changed dramatically. Yeah. And you're just kind of going with it, you know.
But even with on demand and podcasting and whatnot, 90% of audio is live, which I think is fascinating. Mm. So people still want to listen. Now, podcasting is growing and it will grow at on demand, listen when you want to listen. Yeah. But I think, you know, especially with the apps and that whole multimedia function that the likes of News Talk and others have, I think it's really interesting that you know, 9 out of 10 people are listening to stuff, as you see them, are listening probably live to radio.
Yeah. It just feels like you're up to speed if you have the radio on in the background,
yeah.
Particularly with all the stuff that's going on with Brexit and stuff.
Anyway,
sport.
We'll get to what's in the newspapers this morning, actually, and encourage people to go out and buy a few of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I'll just go through the back pages anyway before we really get into this back page of the Sunday Times this morning. It's a picture of George North tackling Ali Price of Scotland yesterday, tightening their grip. Victory over Scots sets Wales up for slam showdown with Ireland on Saturday. And there on the sidebar, Best, we'll go after France from the start. After Rory Best said yesterday he was fairly certain that the World Cup would be the end for him in 2019. On the back page of the Sunday Independent, picture of Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton celebrating last year's brilliant win for Ireland in Paris against France. Come at the hour, they have shown time and again how good they are in preparation for Ireland against France this afternoon. And also there on the bottom, Solskjaer considering legal action against bookmaker. That's after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer hinted he might be taking a bit of action against Paddy Power for use of his face on promotional material. On the back page of the Mail on Sunday, in the clear, offside row rages over Sterling hat-trick as City go 4 points clear of Liverpool at the top of the Premier League. And a picture of Raheem Sterling celebrating his opening goal yesterday, which, if anyone was watching Match of the Day last night, was a country mile offside. And also at the sidebar, Pochettino accuses his Spurs side of arrogance. That's after Spurs fell further back into now a race for Champions League football after a third league defeat in 4. Back at the Sunday Mirror, Sterling service, City 4 points clear of Liverpool as Pep brushes off Juve link. And also then, Man United exclusive, out of this world, Barcelona star wants Old Trafford move. We'll see in the summer how that one goes for Philip Coutinho, whether or not he's going to Old Trafford. To probably join Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, because as the Sunday World say, Ollie's in no rash. Manchester United boss Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has confirmed he will shake up his team for today's vital Premier League clash with Arsenal. And they're hinting as well, Champions League hero Marcus might get rested for the afternoon today. They're also promoting, they have a big Cheltenham 2019 pullout. There's plenty of Cheltenham content across the papers today ahead of that getting underway on Tuesday. We'll be talking about that, obviously. The Star are also going with Philip Coutinho. Come and get me, Phil, plea to United. Philip Coutinho has issued a come and get me plea to Manchester United. Barcelona's Coutinho, 26, has confided in a number of Spanish players that he would love a move to Old Trafford. Love to know how that one will go down with Liverpool fans if it's true. And also on the back page of the Sun then, it's Lolly Gunnar Solskjaer, United 6 mil goodwill gesture. Manchester United will pay Molde £6 million as compensation. Well, as a goodwill gesture, apparently, to appoint Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, even though they could get him for free. Okay, we're going to start today, guys, with the Aviva Stadium this afternoon. You're both going to the match, aren't you? Yeah?
Yes, yeah. Indeed, yeah.
So that's why we're on a little bit earlier than normal today for a Sunday. But anyway, there are a couple of pieces that you found interesting coming in this morning. First one, I think, was Brendan Fanning in the Sunday Independent. Just a very little interesting kind of a, I suppose it's like a profile of French rugby with a number of Irish players who have either played for Ireland against France or who have gone over to France to actually play rugby themselves.
Yeah, like it's game day and there's a lot of stuff about the match, obviously, but, you know, it's all pretty consistent on the theme. Mm. You know, this is the day Ireland get back on the horse type stuff and... You know,
or this is the day we really start panicking.
Yeah, but I think the interesting stuff is around it because, you know, it's a, as I was saying to you before, it's a weird Six Nations. Like it's I just get the sense that there's a theory that Joe Schmidt wouldn't be coaching Ireland now if we hadn't lost Argentina in the last World Cup. That is, he's consumed by the need to right that wrong. And we've seen before when we look ahead, like we saw it in November, the performance against Argentina was poor because all the focus was on the All Blacks. Even in his first season, performance against Australia was poor because focus on the All Blacks. And the whole thing feels like, can we just get this over with? Like, now, there's a lot of talk about getting, you know, return to form and settle confidence and all that. My issue would be, that's fine, but like the whole thing starts again in August anyway. Mm. You know, these aren't bad players. We all know this. Like, this isn't a bad team. We know that they can start again. So, does beating France matter that much? I'd rather know who's our backup fullback.
Yeah.
What happens if Sexton and Carberry are injured? If it's Carty, start him. You know, what happens if Murray's injured? Is it Cooney? He's, you know, 5 minutes off the bench isn't going to do it. So there's all that stuff going on around the match, and then, because it's France, where, you know, the old cliche, we know who knows what France would be.
They must be, I'd say as a journalist, there must be a great team to write about France.
Oh, they're, yeah.
Yeah. There's always something on offer from them.
They're just, it's mad. Like, I did a thing last week on Bernard Laporte. Yeah. Well, I didn't know much about, and I went digging, and like,
I remember the stuff. Joe was talking about it on the panel with the guys last week.
It was links to here, and
he's
in the government, and you know, like, and then he took over training, and maybe that's a threat for Ireland today. Yeah. But he's taken, like, that guy knows what he's doing. You know, he's won two Grand Slams, he turned Toulon into a three-time European Championships. But they're a fascinating thing, and Brendan's done a really nice thing here.
It's a very low-key build-up, isn't it?
It is kind of. Yeah. It's a hard one to, because are we any the wiser if we win by 7 points today?
Yeah, and is this the some of the other piece before, you know, around you know, the 2007 analogy is there, and then you've got the Fergie analogy with the long goodbye with Joe, and now we have Joe's last game in the Aviva managing seat. Like, there's this kind of thing that's kind of this kind of side narrative that's happening as well. And again, you know, as you say, the tired cliche of what France will turn up, but I actually think this year it's actually true, because you don't know what France is going to turn up.
Oh yeah, like I just know from being in here, you're going out of your way not to say it. But you can't help saying it. After the Wales game and then the England game, and then they go and do that to, you know, accomplished professional performance against Scotland. The complete opposite of what
they've
done.
They have some talent. I think Stuart Barnes has mentioned it here about DuPont, the scrum half. Like, he's savage.
Right? Yeah.
And he's saying if he gets on top of Murray, you know, that could swing it. You know, I mean, the likes of the Entomax Young for about half. I mean, even
I think Stuart Barnes said a lovely thing about that, actually. Sooner or later, with the way he's going, people are just going to stop referring to him as Emile's son.
Yeah.
It's like Dean Rock, is it?
Yeah. Anyway, on this Brendan Fanning piece, just to outline the people he's spoken to. So you have Terry Kennedy, who would have played for Ireland between 1978 and 81. Stephen McMahon, who's currently playing for Carrascon. I think he's about 20. He's 23 years old. Then Ken O'Connell, who would have played for Cast in 97 and 98. Kevin Maggs, former Irish international from 97 to 2005. Who had a few years in France as well. Jamie Hagan, former Leinster player, who's currently playing with Beziers over there. He's also spoken to Philip Danaher, the former Irish international. Mike Prendergast, former Munster player, who's had spells playing rugby in France and coaching over there as well, is currently with Stade Francais. And also Dennis Fogarty, the former Munster hooker, who's currently coaching now over there, I think. There are just a couple of nice nuggets about the idea of playing France and just the culture of rugby over there.
Yeah, it's really nicely done. My favourite is Ken O'Connell. I was in school a few years behind him. He was a god. Like, he was this charismatic guy. He was captain, and then he got capped by Munster at 19 against the All Blacks in 89, which was the Buck Shelford and all them.
Yeah.
And I was at the game, and you know, God, O'Connell's playing, and when they did the haka, O'Connell. They lined up and O'Connell was bursting out of the line and dragged them all forward. This is before Willie Anderson did it the following weekend. But he started and he had an amazing game that day, to the point where Shelford took him out of it. Like, you can see it on YouTube now. He hits him with an elbow, deliberately take him out. O'Connell's let off, concussed. And afterwards, Shelford was up in the Dolphin clubhouse going on about who's that effing crazy number seven, you know. The guy was 19. A great player. He probably should have done more with Ireland. He got capped against France, one of those kind of Hail Mary caps, you know, where you're picked to go over to Paris and never seen again.
Yeah.
Apparently, he said in the dressing room before the game, you know, I left and died for you guys today. And then the final score was like France 44, Ireland 3. You know, no one backed him up. No, but he's a great character. And he went over to cast and with Jeremy Davidson. And the story goes that he masqueraded as Davidson's agent and got himself a contract, you know, on the back of it. But he talks about it here, about trying to adjust, that they were used to a culture of, you know, a few beers lashing into the beer after thing.
Himself and Jeremy.
And French would be saying, slow down, and having an egg cup, as he says here, the beer. And
sipping wine instead of beer as well, even
yeah,
half the time.
Sipping wine. He couldn't adjust. What's the quote here? I could take the ball up no problem, but I didn't have the flair they wanted. They let me go because of that, but there were no hard feelings. I won the life, but I didn't win the rugby. It was just, he couldn't adjust to the thing. And that's the theme of the piece.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's really good. And I think, look, on that as well, he talks about it, certain parts of France where it's a real working man's game and a very rural game. And he kind of gets into the belly of that. O'Connell's one of the better ones of these guys, actually. There's other things about fellas, how they adapted, you know, with the French thing. Jamie Hagan talks about this winning away from home culture in France, which we have think is another cliche, but it's actually seems to be true. The other one I find interesting is Mike Prendergast, and only from talking to people who are involved in France and clubs over there, and there's this perception we have, I think, of French club rugby as being, you know, super slick, super professional, well backed.
Yeah.
Whereas in essence, it's really kind of the Eritrea League on steroids, where you've got like, you know, one owner comes in, splashes money around, decides the following year he wants to buy a new yacht, and maybe drops the ball with the club and leaves them there, you know, totally disorganized, you know, journeymen, you know, money grabbers coming in, you know, from Southern Hemisphere for a year or two, no culture of winning, and no backroom. And, you know, this is one thing I found very interesting when talking to people over there is, they pump a lot of money into the first team squad, and then they don't have resources behind that for the academy and proper sports science and stuff that we take for granted because our system is just so good. And I think that's had a hugely detrimental impact on the French team, that culture of, you know, that kind of weak performance culture. And it's touched on here in some of the other pieces, right? Some of these brilliant young players that are coming through. They had an under 20 winning World Cup team, I think. And
I think it's the last couple of seasons they actually have started to. The younger players have been getting more and more.
They're getting lost. They seem to be getting lost in the system then when they go up. And, you know, interestingly though, they're the kind of team that, would you be shocked if they made it to a World Cup semi-final or final? No, because if they got their shit together for 6 weeks and got themselves defensively sorted, you'd actually fancy them to give the World Cup a go.
Likewise, though, you wouldn't be shocked if they didn't get out of their pool.
No, if they were beaten by Reverend Namibia.
But
no, you're right. They are changing the culture. Actually, the Porsche. There was a centre of excellence, academy centre in Paris, and he did away with it. He abolished it and put the emphasis on what Mick is talking about, bringing players through proper academy systems in the clubs. And that started, we've seen the fruits of that.
Yeah. You know? There was an interesting story I liked, one of them from Phil Danaher. Mm. And he was talking about, funny thing, I remember being in Stade de France as part of the management group with Warren Gatland and Donal Lenihan 10 years after my first cap. We were in the tunnel at half time as the lads who were playing really well were coming off. And the size of the average French fella seemed to have shrunk from our days chasing after them. And just the shade really thrown at this. Remarkable how with the full-time training and testing, some of them, who had been like raging bulls back in the amateur era, had gotten smaller.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. They weren't the only country accused of that now back then. But
There was some nut jobs thing. I don't want to be flippant now, but did Marc Cession, do you remember the number 8? I think he blew his wife away with a shotgun or something.
Oh my God.
Something tragic like that. Like, I mean, there was guys crazy. The 91 team, Dubraca and Dantra, these guys, they're animals. Like, you know?
I think Six Nations needs we have very green tinted lens on this stuff, but without a very vibrant France and a very vibrant England, there is no Six Nations, you know. And France have been, I think they're spiralling, you know, and they may be hitting a point of rock bottom and coming back up with their underage stuff. Seems to be a bit of investment there and having a proper look strategically where they're going, because they've lost their way. And I think the Six Nations needs France for commercial reasons, broadcast reasons and everything else, and I think World Rugby needs France.
Well, it's the way the game has gone, isn't it? Because like, it's so scientific now, so pre-programmed.
Yeah.
You know, you're working 20 phases in advance, and they were always best with the unstructured stuff. And the culture is mentioned throughout this now, the Jouet thing. And Dennis Fogarty, the former Munster hooker, John's brother, he talked about going over there, and he says it here. Where was he? He was Aurillac, Agen, and Eau de Provence. And when he went over to France, he said, I decided I needed to try and bring them up to the standards I was used to at Munster. But the coach came to me one day and said, "We are not Munster. We will never be Munster. You will never change us. So do your own thing."
Do you know?
Like, what do you do with that? Like, you know, you're trying to prove things. You know?
Basically,
jouer, jouer, and off we go. Like,
yeah. Were there any other rugby pieces you had your eye on before we move on?
Yeah, though. There's Ian Henderson was put up for the Sundays, yeah. And the lads. He's an interesting guy. And the Peter Riley, Brendan Fannin, Shane McGrath all did. Nice jobs. And Shane in the Mail went more down the angle of he talks about, you know, obviously Brexit, we're a couple of weeks away now from whatever happens there, and he talks about the adjustment of, you know, how things, because you know the Ireland team were up there and they did the yeah. Black Cap tour and stuff, so that's a good read. The piece that I was interested in, was kind of involved in, is sorry, no, it's in the Mail as well, but the Eric Miller interview.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Rory Keane was speaking to.
Yeah, Rory.
Eric Miller.
Rory's a bit like myself. He comes from Cork and he's an AIL background. He's Middleton, I'd be Dolphin, and we try and go to matches when we can. I know you go to AIL games as well, Mick. And there's a new sponsor for the AIL actually, which is encouraging. But we ended up in Sea Point in Kilbogart Park, which is this kind of. It's a
most open place in the world.
It's in the middle of this massive housing estate, totally exposed. It's unlike any rugby ground I've been to, and they were playing Oma, because we work with a guy who's from Oma, so we said we'd go along to this, and the clubhouse is like a little, it's like a barracks or something. Yeah, it doesn't look. We went in there afterwards, and we were just having a few pints, whatever, and you know, because you always feel you can kind of chill out there, and. Next thing I said, is that Eric Miller? You know, because I wasn't sure he was wearing a beanie and stuff, and. Quick out with the Google, and turns out he was coaching Sea Point, so that kind of got the idea. And then Rory met him down in Kilbogart Park last Thursday, and he just opened up on his life. A hell of a player in his day, star on the Lions tour. Walked away from rugby, like he was part of Six Nations. 30 years of age, he walks away because he says it there, it was eating away at him. It, you know, there was financial implications doing that, but he just didn't want to do it anymore. Mick has a good story. He tried to out with the Dublin footballers.
Yeah, this is actually a really, really good piece, I think. And it kind of, it's funny, it doesn't fit in the weekend it's in it, but it's actually really worth the read. Mm. There's no French thing or anything like that, but it's actually, and the Mail have been good enough to pull out all the best quotes for us. But from my own perspective, I remember being an under 21, you're probably relatively fit, and, you know, person on the Dublin 21 panel and whatever else, and Kilmacud McCutter playing Ballybone, it would have been our. The middle class South Dublin rivalry, as it was.
The middle class cup.
Yes. Exactly. Ding, there you go. It's game, let's call it quits. Ballyboden would have been the big rivals, and we played them. We had a very good team, the Ray Cosgroves and Johnny McGee's and all this world in our team. They had a pretty good team. They had one of the Steinses and a couple of other fellas on the Dublin panel. And anyway, Miller came on in the second match. We ended up this trilogy of games, you know, where we were all equally rowed by the referee, but there was so we ended up this replays and stuff. In the second game, he came on and he was just so good. He was just so unlike. And what I just thought about him, like from a rugby perspective, you kind of had this perception of big ogres, but like he was just very talented. He had good feet, good hands, and I think his career was defined by that really early part of his career where he was always the young guy that went on the Lions tour and had this exceptional early part of his career. And he's probably harshly enough, I think, judged in some respects. But you read some of the stuff here around. And he seems to be a deeply kind of insightful guy when he comes to rugby anyway. And he talks about the team that he played on and how they didn't achieve what they achieved, which would be a common enough theme from fellas who played in that era. About Joe Schmidt, which is very interesting. He talks about how he admires Joe. But really, you know, how do we play when things go wrong? You know, and it's kind of what he's trying to ask there. And on the French, he's talking about, you know, he's getting really into the belly of, you know, why don't they turn up? You know, they have these brilliant, very, very strong characters, but, you know, it doesn't seem to be happening for them. And it's really, really good. I know Hugh has some of the personal stuff as well.
Rory said, like, he spoke to him for about 50 minutes and then he had to go out training on a filthy night, you know, and the coaching seems to be vocation for him. Like, Rory said he could have talked for an hour and a half, you know. Yeah. But the coaching story is fascinating because, like, he talks about developing players and the life, and it's not just about, you know, which ruck you hit or whatever. Mm. It's about how you're getting on with the mortgage. You know, if you can't train today, that's okay. Give me a shout after. It's all that. He's big into all that kind of stuff. But as part of his coaching career, he ended up in Sri Lanka. Which I didn't know.
Yeah, this is the absolutely fascinating part of it.
It's incredible stuff. Now, we didn't focus on it. Overall in the headline and stuff, we mentioned Sri Lanka thing because I think he doesn't want to go big in it, right? But
yeah.
He was coaching schools rugby in Sri Lanka and they have this kind of massive schools rivalry.
The Bradby Shield.
The Bradby Shield, which gets 20,000 people at the game and is on national TV. The president of Sri Lanka was there and all this. So he's coaching over there. He has his wife and a young daughter over there. And his wife is volunteering in the local orphanage. And she develops a bond with one of the girls there. I think it's Nisha is her name.
Yeah, Nisha.
Who suffers from a rare form of cerebral palsy. And they just decide, we're going to adopt this girl because it is a bond. And then what they had to go through to adopt it, the red tape, he ended up having to come home with his daughter while his wife stayed in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, I think she was there for a further 100-odd days while they were dealing with all the lawyers and all the situations and circumstances. I came back to work here and brought our oldest daughter back.
Yeah, and like, I didn't know any of this. He didn't make a big deal about it. He just said, this is what happened. And now she's settled down happily in Ireland and saw that. But it just shows you, you know, an insight into the guy and how he... There's depths to him, you know. It's because a lot of modern rugby now, you just get cliches and all that. But this guy has real perspective.
It's worthy of even more space, to be honest with you.
It's a
really, really good article.
We're back to the online thing. If you had that, you could give it like 4,000 words.
Yeah.
We were constrained to 1,500, I think. And then you're putting out, as Mick says, putting out stuff in the panel just to get more in. You know,
it's great. No, it's really really well worth the read.
Yeah, that's good now.
That it for the rugby,
yes.
I would say, because we have plenty more to get through. A couple of bits this afternoon. I think we're going to soccer next. We were talking, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer obviously is all over the papers for the miraculous job he seems to be doing with United and the miraculous job they did on Wednesday night in the Champions League. But there were a couple of interesting pieces you liked in particular.
Yeah, I'm a United fan, and I actually went to the Guardian podcast live, and Barry Glendening described Manchester United as your friend who used to have a mini drink problem 5 years ago but was great crack on a night out and then went off it for 5 years and got really boring and now he's back on the jar.
I'm
going on a drink today, that's what happened in my head. But I'm going to have a pint later on. No, but the point being is, as a United fan, it's like we've been in this dark abyss of Moyes, Van Gaal and Mourinho, and now we have it's great crack. It's like a train that's careering out of control. It's brilliant. But this piece with Solskjaer, a couple of really interesting bits, the Paddy Power bit that you mentioned earlier on, and you know, he just seems to have just got it right. And
This one's with Jonathan Northcroft
in
the Sunday Times.
Apologies,
a profile of him, and he's kind of recalling a time, what was it, about 15, 16 years ago when he interviewed Ole Gunnar Solskjaer when he had a very serious knee injury.
Yeah, and it's a really good piece. Like, there's a load of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer stuff in the paper today and people saying give him the job and all that kind of stuff. But this guy gets into the belly of, you know, why is he the guy he is? And, you know, bearing in mind this guy was, you know, sacked by Cardiff as well, you know, let's not forget. But he has some really nice touches here. Stuff about when he was injured and he was coming back from injury in 2003, 4, 5, that kind of time when he would have been coming to the end of his career. And just that sheer kind of bloody mindedness. And again, that kind of Norwegian thing, he's a really kind of humble hero. And watching his interview online the other night, he was talking about, he thanked everybody, you know, but himself. He was talking about the players, he was talking about the old manager, he was talking about this and the backroom staff. And he's a really humble, hardworking kind of guy. And I think there's a couple of lines here. One I like here is the three things that were striking. Yeah. First, Ollie's complete lack of self-pity and therefore ego. Now, this is when he's come back from a serious injury. Second, his unnatural ability to fixate on positives while still being injured. And third, his superhuman willpower to be involved in carrying out every last necessity of that monotonous long shot rehab. And I think when you look at United now and you see, you know, what did they need in the, you know, coming out of that kind of really dark end of Mourinho period, was someone with absolute positivity, someone who was just going to get stuck in and just bring that feel good positivity back to Manchester United, and he's been it, and you know, this is a really good piece by Northcroft, and there's a couple of other, you know, little gems throughout this, but for me this is probably the best of the Solskjaer pieces today.
But as a United fan there, Shane McGrath has his column on in the Mail. Like, he says his line here, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was as loved in Ireland this week as much as any hurler or footballer. Manchester United feel vital again, and there are thousands of fans in this country feel the return of an old confidence they will say has been dormant for too long. Is that how it is as a fan?
Yeah, it is.
Shane makes the point that it's been hard to watch Liverpool rise up for United fans? Or
I think, look, there is this, you know, we've a complex patchwork of sporting passions in this country, right? And I think it was always back in the day, and I remember being in GA clubs in Dublin in the 90s and people cheering for France against Ireland in rugby because they just hated everything about the Irish rugby team, and that's a fact. I think it's far less now, though. I think there's a thing now where people are sporting fans now, and you can be, and that's why I think there's a bit of a, you know, slight burst of the bubble with rugby now. People are happy to go from bandwagon to bandwagon, and where we all love sport. Doesn't mean if I can stand on Hill 16 one day, doesn't mean I can't go to the Aviva the next day, or I can't support the women's hockey team, or take joy in you know, Kieran McGeehan or something. You know, like, I think people can flip between sports now. I think Shane McGrath's piece kind of, he touches on this a little bit, this whole kind of thing around soccer, and, you know, there's this kind of snobbery around, you know, well, why would you support a Premier League team? You know, go watch a League of Ireland team, or go watch Gaelic games, and they're our sport. And, you know, these fellas are tattooed aliens over in the UK making billions, you know. So, but he talks about, you know, there's stories that explain the pervasive popularity of the Premier League. This kind of sniffiness at Irish people supporting English teams remains a common pose. It's its roots in history and a particular belief that a passion for GAA is a more fitting pastime for patriotic people. And I think, you know, I think we have to blow this thing up in this country, you know. I think, you know, you can support Manchester United, and we do have this deep heritage of soccer fandom in this country, and it's huge. And similarly, we have brilliant indigenous Gaelic games, and we have a brilliant history of rugby and all this other stuff. And I think McGrath, kind of, it goes off point a little, but he starts with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as how he's kind of ignited this kind of little passion in Man United fans. Again, as a United fan, I'd agree with that. But it doesn't make me any less a Dubs fan or whoever else as well, you know. So,
the concept that possibly people might struggle with is, you know, can you be so passionate about a place that you're not directly affiliated to? Whereas if you're passionate about Dublin football, it's easy to explain. Do you know what I mean?
But
like, that's something that I can't, my emotions can't be affected by a team that doesn't care if I live or die 700 miles away.
No, and I think, you know, and I think it's quite complex. And I think there's a couple things. One is emigration. And I think a lot of people in Ireland would have emigrated, my parents included, to a place in the UK. And sport, their sporting outlet may have been going to watch a Premier, or was a football league match back then. I think that's one part. We have a very strong connection. Donegal people in Glasgow, Irish people, you know, Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester, London. And I think there's a genuine connection with those places. It's not Borussia Dortmund, right? It's somewhere that's across the water that, you know, Dublin was, for all intents and purposes, a colonial outpost and a tough town, the same as Glasgow, Liverpool, like, just drop and fit. You know, so there is a connection of people there as well. And I think that was passed down from generation. I think soccer, football had been a working class game, and I think people would, you know, travel in there and still travel in their thousands. Now, I'm not that kind of real passionate. I get on the boat at 5 o'clock on a Saturday morning and go watch a Premier League match. But I can understand where it comes from.
You refer to United as we?
No. I don't. But I think the 80s did a I think the 80s did a job, didn't I? We have a lot of Irish, like Roy King, captain Manchester United. You know, he's from Cork. You know, you had three fellas playing for Manchester United, and lads who won multiple European Cups. You think about it now, the Ronnie Whelans and Mark Lawrence, who were fellas who played for Ireland, who were winning stuff at the highest level. I think the advent of professionalisation of rugby in this country changed the dynamic, because people had something great to watch at home all of a sudden, and the GAA becoming much more kind of accessible and better quality has also changed that dynamic as well. And the League of Ireland is now changing the dynamic, I think, a little bit from a football perspective, and that people are beginning to go, it's almost become hipster to go watch League of Ireland,
is there an upsurge in League of Ireland?
I've just noticed, I could be completely wrong, but what I think I've noticed in certainly the first few weeks of this season is I see a lot more people talking about it probably than I would have even this time last year. And I think in part as well, when they changed that rule to allow the kind of goals be posted online as soon as they happened.
Oh yeah.
I've seen way more excitement on Friday and Saturday nights rather than people having to wait until Monday evening to watch it.
There's always an appeal of live sport. I've been to Cork City a few times, and Turner's Cross is one of the best.
Yeah, it is.
And there's a great definite buzz there, and it's always good to watch live sports. But I didn't think there was. You're always reading about crisis in the League of Ireland. I didn't realize they turned a corner, or hopefully.
Well, like, unfortunately, it's never too far down the track in the League of Ireland. But look, the early signs this season, the attendance of matches seems to be quite good. I know I saw St. Pat's, they were turning people away at Richmond Park at St. Pat's on Friday night.
That's great.
I saw Dan McDonald tweet that a fella sold his ticket for 25 quid outside the ground to a tout. He said it's the first time he's ever heard of a fella who's, he said, is this the road to Damascus moment? Like, is this the epiphany? Like, a fella's, you know, selling a League of Ireland ticket above odds outside the ground. Normally, the thing was you'd get the first prize was two tickets, the second prize was four kind of job. But yeah, I think Rovers is a big thing. I mean, Rovers have got their house in order, beautiful stadium, big fan base, Bose obviously big, and then Dundalk and Cork have been absolutely brilliant. So there's a bit of colour. It's a different buzz, right? It's very male, it's young, it's fireworks, it's edgy.
Yeah.
But if that's what you want, you know, it'll give it to you in spades, and the quality is better.
Yeah,
certainly is. Okay, we'll move on from that. There are some GA pieces as well this afternoon. You mentioned the Brexit situation with Ian Henderson was talking about it earlier on, and there were a couple of pieces on that as well in terms of GA this afternoon. Joe Brawley has a pretty lengthy piece on the back page of the Sunday Independence sports supplement.
Yeah, and cue all your listeners tuning out when you mention Brexit, but it is actually quite a good piece. It's a funny weekend for GA. It's a kind of an in-betweeny weekend, as I'd call it, for the better word, technical word.
If it wasn't for so many postponements last weekend, it would have been a pretty fallow week.
It's a very fallow week. You've got the two hurling matches and bits and bobs, really. So there's a bit of focus on Leitrim. There's a good interview with Rochford, which we might come to later on. Mm-hmm. Brexit. Brawley has a piece. There's another article as well on this as well somewhere.
I think it was Michael Clifford in the Mail.
Clifford, yeah. And there's another person as well. There's two or three of them that touch on...
Mick Foley in the Times.
Mick Foley, sorry, apologies. There's a very good article on it too. But Brawley, Ben Brawley, he takes the first half of his article to bury the DUP. And in fairness, he has a good cut-off Sinn Féin as well. And he just talks about how the North has drifted and how GA people, you know, are kind of, you know, at this crossroads again. And I suppose the inherent danger of what might happen if all this unfolds after, you know, 20 years or more of peace or more again. And he talks about the role the GA might play. And look, I know the GA, you know, has done an awful lot of work to unravel itself. And it's very much seen as apolitical and would take that stance, and rightfully so. But can the GA or should the GA play any role in what's happening and unfolding in front of us, as much as we can decipher what is unfolding in front of us? It's a good piece. It's worth reading, simply because Brawley has such a good way with English at times. So
it just emphasises, though, like, it's quite biting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it really is.
No, and it just shows you. Now, we won't get into it, but like, I don't think Brexit's going to happen, so this is all, you know, moot in a sense, but it can't. But anyway, like, what he's talking about, he's quite strong, and he's very clear where he's coming from, even though, as Mick says, he does have a pop-up Sinn Féin, but he quotes Arlene Foster here when she referred to the Irish Language Act in 2017 and said, if you feed the crocodile, it'll only come back for more. Yeah. And then he goes after that. And
there was a fascinating story as well. Dropped in as well, a story a few years ago as part of our organ donation campaign. We held an awareness day in Belfast. I was there with the transplant teams, organ donation nurses and all the rest of us. I'd invited DUP Health Minister Jim Wells. It is obviously of great importance that the Health Minister understands the life and death area in order that he can make an informed judgment about whether or not to support or what to support or not to support. Throughout the event, Jim sneeringly described me in the presence of stunned transplant surgeons and nurses as the Londonderry GA player who brought the Sam Maguire back to the United Kingdom. I laughed it off, but that was the Health Minister.
Yeah. But I think, I think one of the main focus of his piece, and it's slightly different to the Michael Foley one, is I think he just is despairing at the basket case that Northern Ireland has become with a non-existent government. You've one of the biggest parties doesn't take their seats in Westminster. Mm. You've no functioning society as he sees it, despite the fact that there's peace. And he's kind of saying, well, look, don't let communities kind of, you know, suffer, and can the GA, being such a large part of that, play some kind of role in what comes next? I think the Mick Foley piece, without skipping on too much, he focuses in on Oisín McConville, and McConville's very interesting. Wouldn't be a guy that would be political in any way, shape or form. But he's from obviously from Cross McGlen, which had its difficulties in the past. But he's talking about, you know, like, hard border. He says it's even hard to contemplate. You know, why would anybody want to jeopardise what we have now? Beggar's belief. for some kids up here, you don't even want them growing up in the same environment as we did. People in the community I live in feel isolated. And he finishes up with a, you know, people have so much shit going on in their lives, so much stuff going on in their lives, the last thing they want is to start fighting again, you know. If it's a fight no one wants, it's a fight that no one will win. And it's just, it's quite depressing, yeah.
It is depressing. Like, I mean, like, it's very interesting, and Bradley's a good read, and Mick Foley and Mick Clifford as well, but you can see people taking entrenched positions again. And
yeah.
You know, take, you know, just, it's heavy going. I mean, Clifford's point in the Mail is that, you know, the GAA are being urged to promote a United Ireland.
Yeah.
To come out behind that. And he's saying, you know, they can't even get their own house in order, and, you know, he's taking a kind of a wry look at it. But as Mick says, the overall, you know, horizon, it's just, it's hard going.
Well, I think it's, I think we've all woken up and realised that this is, it may or may not happen. And,
I think, and without going back to rugby too much, but I think rugby is well adjusted that way. I mean, from the Henderson piece earlier and stuff, you know, like the hockey we saw with the women's hockey team in summer, it's a 32 county game.
Yeah.
The price you pay is Ireland's call. No, I know there's, yeah, like, yeah, you know, people come out and ranting about this, why are we singing this, you know, Wolf Tone stuff. Yeah.
But we all know there is a serious reason why
it brings everyone together.
Yeah,
and, you know,
you might like the song, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And like, it's great. We've a captain from the north, you, yeah, know, and plenty of players, and it just works, you know, yeah, as AIL up and down. And then you see what's going on in the GA and how, now it's obviously far different history there,
yeah,
but it would just be very grim if it goes back to anything like that.
Yeah, no, it's they're worth reading for people in
interest.
They
are worth reading. The other
there's a bit of Leitrim stuff which is good. It's kind of, you know, I think it was in some respects you know, done a bit last week. But the Rochford interview, there's a few Rochford interviews. Rochford and the Mail again, which is a lot of good stuff this week actually. And he talks about Mayo past, you know, misses. He's in his, I think, an AIB. It's a pure gig, but it looks fit. An AIB ambassador,
oh, yeah,
because he would have been involved as a player and a manager, I think.
He's holding up an AIB.
Yes, and he's holding AIB ball, which is probably the hint. Yeah, it's probably the other. Sorry, yeah. Fair point.
You should have spotted these things.
I know, bald people. I have the paper folded over. You see, that's the problem. It's a good article. And look, we were talking about it earlier. There's a couple of things strike me about Rochford. One is, I don't know, like, how he's being judged, you know, and I don't know, you know, look at your life about how other people judge you, but I think James Horne left Mayo kind of with a, you know, with his reputation intact, as has been seen by his return. And you look at Rochford and you go, he kind of left, you know, I think a little bit, even though in some ways he probably got even closer than Horne did, and he got Mayo to that point where people talk about Dublin being the best team of all time, and
yeah,
they could have beaten Dublin twice at least. So he did something right, and I don't know whether he's kind of caught in this. He took over a good team and he didn't deliver, or I don't know. And I think he seems to be a bit of a crossroads. He's a guy that I don't think is going to disappear and start watching Coronation Street on a Tuesday night.
No, and as he pointed out himself, I mean, he was gone from Mayo 3 weeks later. He was, he said it certainly wasn't a knee-jerk reaction, but I think he said pretty much within 3 weeks he was off at Donegal.
Yeah, and I think that'll be a very interesting one to unfold. He comes across with some interesting stuff here, and it's something that teams, rurally based teams, in a better way of saying it, have yeah, said about
players based in,
yeah,
Dublin.
Yeah, he says it's up to the county board to find the means to get them employment in Mayo, which I think is very interesting.
It's really interesting.
It sounds like a huge, yeah, difference,
though. It's a really interesting point, and I think back in the day, some of the Ulster teams kind of forged this course of trying to get fellas to work 3 day weeks in the summertime. You often find Gaelic football teams get much better in the summer. Now, that makes obvious sense because they're training. But
yeah,
college lads come back, they more or less work. Maybe they might do a bit of coaching in the local club, but they're full-time. And you can see the standards of fitness and football get better and better and better. And I think the feeling is that if you can get your guys doing as little work as possible and living locally and cutting out the commutes and the travels, it makes obvious sense to me that, yeah, that would have a big benefit. There's a massive financial implication to that. And that's why you see things like, you know, fundraising and commercial boards and that kind of stuff popping up, because it's an expensive business if you want to win in All-Ireland. It's not about necessarily the physios, and it's about being able to enable fellas to maximise what they have.
Yeah, and Mayo even are only one of countless teams across the county who have a core group of players who are based up in Dublin. Maybe there might be other counties of lads based in Cork or some of the other bigger cities, but, you know, you've upwards of 10, 15 lads training separate from the team on a Tuesday or Wednesday night.
And I think AIL, from looking at other sports as well, like there's been a drain of players to Dublin as well, and Dublin clubs have dominated, like, in a way, and Dublin club couldn't win a AIL to save their lives.
Yeah, you look at the glory days of the AIL back in the 90s, and now you look at Shannon, Young Monster, Gary Owen.
Limerick guys up in Dublin, like yourself, and Cork lads, and, you know, they're all going to Dublin clubs, and there's been an upturn there. But I find Ratchford very likeable, and, you know, he came so close. Like, I mean, they say in the
opening, the manager who went closest to beating Dublin. No, not Stephen Rochford is not about to get this printed on a business card.
But you know, Horan's back there for a second go at it now, obviously. But they became a kind of a. It reminds me a bit of Munster when Declan Kinnegan had them so close, goes away, comes back, and then the Holy Grail and all that stuff. And Horan's going to do it now. But like, I didn't know what Mick was saying there, that he didn't leave with as much a positive legacy as Horan, because
I don't think he wasn't a darling. Like, I think Horan, the media, and I think Horan was seen as, you know, a top class manager, and I don't think unfairly that Rochford was put in the same bracket.
Do you think maybe people kind of got the impression that Rochford just kind of
The team
was built, and he just brought it a little bit further on where Horan kind of started it all.
Is that the perception that's
out there, really? Not necessarily what I think.
And people who are closer to it will have a far different perception. Yeah. I'm just looking at it from, you know, from a Dublin, you know, you read what you read and what you see, and I don't think he was as given the credit that he deserved. Would be what I'd say. And okay. I think last year when they ran out of road, I think it was a natural kind of tired team thing to do, where they just went out early, and probably the best thing that could have happened to them, to be honest, in some respects.
Yeah, like, even just, I think even some of those Mayo supporters needed a summer off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were, no, I like, I,
to the edge
I,
so often.
Like, I'm only partly joking. Like, I know a lot of people from Mayo, and just seeing them every August and September.
Drained.
Emotionally, absolutely drained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, I remember, you know, Dublin beat Mayo that time there a couple of years ago. It was like some dub said beside me, it's like hitting your sister, like you get no crack out of it. So they're just seeing them drained of it just means so much. You know, I was at a wedding in Mayo.
Hit the sister after a few cans, yeah.
Jesus Christ. My point is there was no joy in it.
But as an aside, and I always think this when I read about GA managers, and I defer to your GA knowledge here, but there's all this talk. Oh, I had a contract up to 2020. I had a deal to thing. Mm. I thought they weren't paid.
That's an agreement, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not. They're not full time employees, but they're given a term, which gives certainty to them and gives certainty to the squad. Yeah. But that
and expenses not that are built into that.
Yeah. Well, like this is one of the grey areas that, you know, I think if you flash back to rugby in the 90s, I'd say it's pretty similar in that, you know, there's a lot of grey areas around.
Yeah.
You know, mileage and expenses are things, and look, I have no issue with managers. Like, they should not be out of pocket for running their county team, and in fact should be heavily compensated for doing so, because they're in the media glare. They're expected to be spokespersons for the team, train the team 4 or 5 nights a week, put their lives on hold, and
but just have it all above the counter,
and under massive pressure. And I think that, you know, the mileage and the expenses and whatever else that goes with it, you know,
fair play,
you know, if they, whatever, you know, I don't have any issue with that.
Mm-hmm. And on Dublin as well, he's talking the other teams. Honestly, I think the gap is closing. The gap closing?
I think nothing lasts forever. I think Kilkenny, the gap, you know, people talk about Kilkenny, and I think Dublin are similar. I think I think the gap is closing, and I think Dublin have had an exceptionally good team, an exceptionally good manager. And at times the field has been weak. And I think what's happening now is that there's 4 or 5 other teams are catching up. And even the next tier teams are getting better. And I think with this elephant and Dublin, you know, they've had unique players, once in a generation players like Stephen Cluckton and Brogans and stuff of this world, who, you know, are almost irreplaceable. Now they've a whole heap of other ones coming through that look almost irreplaceable as well. But I think the gap, Dublin have no divine right to win on Ireland this year. I think it's going to be close. And in fact, the Super 8s have made it so that Dublin could have got to an All-Ireland final in the past, having played one Division 1 team, having come to Leinster, and, you know, you get to maybe a semi-final, you get somebody. Now going into Super 8s, you'll probably have to play 3 Division 1 teams there, if minimum 2, and you'll have to play another one in a semi-final, and probably another one. So you have 4 or 5 Division 1 teams to get through to win in All-Ireland this year, which is great, but it also makes it so much harder for Dublin, and that criticism of coming through Leinster and getting a free crack at that run is that that criticism is now gone, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. So
we'll get into Croke Park another day. We'll get into Croke Park another day. Before we wrap up, though, there's a huge amount of Cheltenham coverage, obviously. Cheltenham Festival getting underway this Tuesday.
Huge topic.
There were a couple of pieces you had picked out.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't purport to be a racing fan by any stretch. And to be honest, I have a bit of an issue with Cheltenham. I don't think we cover ourselves in glory to a degree when you have television images of florid-faced, you know, Irish lads off their tree singing ole, 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 you know, on a sport that essentially revolves around gambling. But anyway, but there are great stories in racing, and it has a huge cultural impact, particularly in this country. Mm-hmm. And the interview with Ruby Walsh that Philip Quinn did in the Mail is very good.
There's one small line, actually, just that jumped out at me even in it. Whereabouts am I going now? Whether this week's, he's talking about how he's won 14 of the major races out there. Whether this week includes another major remains to be seen, but Walsh's aim is to ride a winner and be on the plane home on Friday night that he booked.
Well, I think with Ruby, I think what I find fascinating with this interview is the kind of company he keeps, and he has a lot of non-racing analogies that he brings in throughout the article. And you look at the kind of guys that he talks about, Henry Shefflin, you know, Paul O'Connell, Ronan O'Gara, Johnny Sexton, and you get a sense of a fella that's absolutely obsessed with his sport and obsessed with performing to the best of his ability, which these guys that you mentioned there are. And he talks about, you know, the exhilaration of being in the arena and having to perform, which hurling record breaker Henry Shefflin likened to a drug. You know, he asks about, would he be scared to think of a Cheltenham without him? And he quips, it's effing petrifies me. Mm. And he talks about his stuff, and he even at the very end concludes with that, you know, what would you do if you weren't horses? And he talks about managing the All Blacks.
I coach the All Blacks with Ronan O'Gara, who's a mate of his.
But he goes,
it's a good piece.
If there were no horses? What then? What would it be? I wouldn't be the president of Ireland, that's for sure. I wouldn't be the Taoiseach either. Jesus, can you think of anything worse? 400 beds in the corridor in Talla. What are you going to do about it? What the fuck can I do about it?
But it's a good piece, and I think
he's very raw, isn't he?
He's raw. Yeah.
And he's a big figure. I mean, everyone knows Ruby Walsh. He's charismatic. He's hugely, as Mick says, successful at what he does. And then he Philip kind of puts this to him. You know, this is the biggest week of racing in the year, and you're a marquee guy. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, as Tony McCoy always says, when people stop recognizing you are effed, I'm a jockey, I'm not a rock star. But he is kind of a rock star in racing terms, as Philip says.
Irish sport, yeah. I'd say he's one of the most recognisable in Irish sport, would you say?
Oh, he is,
In this niche, he would be, you know. And he plays it down, it's just one week of the year, there's 51 other weeks. But, you know, it's a hell of a week, and he's front and centre.
And Cheltenham is a big deal. Like I think, look, back in the day, there was this bookie crazed mania, you know, there was, you know, €5 betting vouchers with every paper, and you know, we had this kind of unhealthy. And look, I think racing's at a bit of a juncture too. And what I find interesting in terms of its relationship with gambling, and gambling now been in the spotlight now as something that needs to be addressed as a societal issue. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult extract the two from each other. Like, and I think what I like about some of the Cheltenham stuff today is, there's this historical piece in the Sindo, which is not bad, and then there's a really good piece in the Sunday Times with Willie Mullins' nephew David
Mullins,
which you pointed out to us, which actually is really interesting, and it's the psychology that, you know, you don't think of some of this stuff, but this lad won a Grand National winner as a teenager in Aintree, obviously, and hasn't had a winner in Cheltenham, and how it's almost, even he's a young guy, you can almost hear it weighing on his shoulders as he talks throughout the piece.
Yeah, like he says, you're talking to someone who's after being beaten 38 times at Cheltenham. I don't really like Cheltenham so far. It's the loneliest place in the world if you're not winning. But it's Cheltenham, so you build yourself up. I want a winner there. No one remembers second, third or fourth. Others might, I don't.
Yeah. But it's interesting what Mick says about the gambling thing, because all the pictures we'll see in the next week, it all revolves around people making money, you know, betting on it. Now, The counter argument is that there's betting on every sport. There'll be betting on the match today in Lansdowne, you know, soccer obviously, but it's so inextricably linked with racing. I mean, if you weren't allowed to gamble on racing, would you watch it? I, you know, hypothetically, is it just about what the horses can earn you. I always think, you know, when the horse dies, like best mate or whatever, and you get these obituaries on the back pages of sports papers, oh, he was a wonderful personality, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, like he's Jasper Carrot or something. And you could have the horse that wins nothing and he gets a bullet to the head and he could be Ricky Gervais. You know, like, I just find it weird. I think it's elevated to a level based on how successful the horse is, and we try and attach romance to racing, and it's a hard-nosed business. Like.
It is, but I think what may come out of all this is that there's exceptional bravery of the jockeys and exceptional talent and breeding and all that kind of stuff, and people know a lot more than I do about it, understand the skill that's behind it. And I think what is happening a bit today is there's actually a load of stuff here, and there's not one bookies odd mentioned.
Good. Mm-hmm. And it's very personality driven.
There's good stuff here. And I'm going, geez, I never thought of that, you know, from this young lad's perspective, and the weight of expectation on him and the pressure he puts on himself, or what makes Ruby Walsh tick, and, you know, at his age, stick it up on a horse and put himself in that, you know, firing line, when a better way of saying it.
Yeah, what I like about him in it as well is he's talking about how he doesn't necessarily just try to do the things that everyone else is doing. Like, he's talking about riding Faheem there recently enough. He sometimes takes chances. At Punchestown last April, he rode Faheem. The former champion hurdler had run a dull race at Cheltenham, and they were trying 3 miles for the first time, searching for a spark. The bland expectation was that he would be ridden quietly to conserve his stamina. Willie said, "What are you going to do?" When I said I was going to bounce out and make the running. And he kind of looked at me as if I had 10 heads, but then said, "Right, okay, that's fine." Faheem won by 13 lengths.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you don't always just have to follow. It's just a nice... He comes across as someone that kind of just tries to forge his own path a little bit.
Yeah. And what a hard path. I mean, even you know, I don't know what their pay jockeys are. I mean, are they well compensated for this, for the commitment they have to give to diet and all that? I was talking to somebody who was big into racing the other day about when the weather's bad. They've no heat protection in what they're wearing. They're wearing this flimsy kind of thing,
I'd say, I'm sure even any ounce of weight would be something that they don't want to have.
It's incredibly hard life, and the commitment to it.
Not to mind the injuries and the falls.
Yeah.
And he talks about as well here the uncertainty of the job, and I think, you know, it's something you don't think about either. And look, I suppose Eamon Dunphy was the first to really unfold all this, but his brilliant book a long time ago now. Yeah. Only a Game, I think it is. And then, like, he talks about here about, I never really thought about getting a job. I have a little bit of security, and I know I'm going to be riding at the big meetings, but this game's a bit disheartening. Like, I had a good punch down last year, but it doesn't guarantee you at all that you're going to get a ride in the next big race. You know, so he talks about all these plethora of jockeys out there who are living week to week, month to month. And it's that kind of, I wouldn't quite call it an underbelly, but it's just that kind of side of racing that you don't necessarily get.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so...
Right, I think that is that probably looks like our lot for the afternoon. Yeah. For anyone at home, go out and buy a paper anyway. You can listen back. We'll have this podcast on offtheball.com later this afternoon, or you can watch it back in full again on all of our social channels. Don't forget to join us as well on Off the Ball on the radio at 1 o'clock. We'll have commentary 2 Premier League games this afternoon. We'll have Chelsea against Wolves from 2:05. Ian Beach and Kenny Cunningham on commentary. And also at 4:30, we'll have Arsenal against Manchester United, Stephen Doyle and Gary Breen at the Emirates. Andy Dunn is also going to be at the Aviva Stadium for us this afternoon to keep us up to date on Ireland against France. Until next week, though, on the Sunday Papers, we'll see you then.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.